Well, thank you everyone again for joining us. This event is brought to you by a grant from the Johnstown Fulton Foundation. And it's co-sponsored by the Federal Society and the Business Law Society. And by the way, if you're interested in joining, it's not too late. You can talk to myself or to Casey if you're interested in joining the Business Law Society. Talk to me if you're interested in joining the Federal Society. Well, today we are very honored to have not one but two of the nation's leading scholars on securities law. Our guest speaker is Professor Todd Henderson, who teaches corporate, securities, banking, and M&A law at the University of Chicago Law School. He has clerked on the Second Circuit in New York, litigated at the appellate level for Kirkland and Ellis in Boston, and managed for McKinsey and Company Kirkland and Ellis in Washington, D.C.
Correct,
right. Getting these confused. Managed for McKinsey and Company in Boston and designed construction projects for Raytheon in Los Angeles.
All of that came first.
I'm also very grateful to have one of my all-time favorite professors at Meyer School of Law with us today. Professor Donna Nagy is the C. Ben Dutton Professor of Law. She teaches corporate and securities law and has co-authored books on securities litigation and insider trading. Prior to teaching, Professor Nagy was an associate at Debevoise and Plimpton in Washington, D.C., specializing in securities enforcement and litigation. Thank you both for joining us today. And as our moderator, we have the president of the Business and Law Society, Casey Plant, who is going to introduce the debate format and the topic. Casey,
thanks, Harmon.
Good afternoon, everyone. Start off by telling you how the debate today is going to work. First of all, I'm going to frame the issues that will be discussed today and tell you a little bit about the current state of the law. I'll then let Professor Henderson speak for 10 minutes, move on to Professor Nagy, who will respond and make some points of their own in the next 10 minutes. At that point, I will pose questions to which each side will have a chance to respond. We anticipate that will take about 40 minutes, so after that, we'll release people if they need to move on to class. Finally, we'll take some audience Q&A for those of you that are able to stick around, so looking forward to a great event. The courts have long recognized the private right of action against securities fraud perpetrators. In 2008, the Supreme Court in the Stone Ridge case had to decide whether to extend that right to secondary actors. So in other words, not the primary actor of the securities fraud, but to someone who allegedly aided and abetted the primary actor in perpetrating that fraud, but isn't alleged to have actually committed the fraud themselves. The court in the Stone Ridge case held that the private right did not extend to such actors, because investors did not rely on any statement or misrepresentation that the secondary actors had made. Recently, Senator Arlen Specter introduced a bill that would overrule the Stone Ridge case. And if you look on the handouts we passed around, it's the language at the top of the handout. Basically, it would propose the following change to the 1934 Exchange Act. Section 21D of the Securities Exchange Act is amended by adding at the end of the following: private civil action. For purposes of any private civil action implied under this title, any person that knowingly or recklessly provides substantial assistance to another person in violation of this title, or any rule or regulation issued under this title, shall be deemed to be in violation of this title to the same extent as the person to whom such assistance is provided. Recently, this language has been incorporated into Senator Chris Dodd's Mammoth Financial Regulation Bill, which, if adopted, would essentially overhaul the entire financial system. And with that introduction, I think I'll pass over to Professor Henderson to begin his talk.
Thank you so much for having me. I was having dinner last night with my parents who were visiting, and my mom asked me what the debate was about. It's not exactly the easiest thing to explain to someone who's a layperson. And so I summed up, I said, look, the question really for the case is, when you've got bad actors, and clearly the parties here, which I'll describe in a second, were bad actors, do we want the government or private lawyers and private plaintiffs to prosecute these cases? And my mom, knowing me fairly well, she did give birth to me and raise me, said, well, you know, of course, you're going to come out on the side of having the private actors do this, because she knows I'm a Federalist Society guy. I'm sort of a small government person and not really that trusting of the government. And so I think she was kind of surprised when I come out on the other side of this question, and I'll tell you why that is. before I tell you a little some important facts, I'll say a couple things. First of all, this is really policy, not law. There's a shockingly little amount of law involved in what the court did, what the court does in any of these securities law cases. They're making policy. Maybe that's true of all the Supreme Court cases, but it is especially true here. The case is really more about civil procedure than it is about securities regulation. It's in the context of securities regulation. But really, this case and lots of others like it are about the failure of federal courts under the current rules of civil procedure. There have been some recent Supreme Court cases which have tried to move to amend the civil procedure rules to try to solve this problem generally. I'm thinking here about Twombly and Iqbal, and we can talk about that more later. But this Stoneridge case is just the latest in the court's attempt to sort of achieve the same objectives within the specific area of securities regulation. And then finally, the path the court takes to get to the answer, and I think Casey's right when he says that they focused on the reliance element here, is completely wrong. And will cause a lot more mischief, although that may be good for all of us because mischief generates fees, which may be good for lawyers, but they completely screwed up, and it was Justice Kennedy, which shouldn't be surprising because he has a nice history of doing this. Okay, so what happened in this case, quickly, you probably read this thing, Charter Communications, they agreed to overpay by $20 for the set-top boxes that sit on top of your television for cable TV. They're going to pay their suppliers $20 more than they should. And in return, the suppliers are going to pay $20 more for advertising than they should. And this transaction has absolutely no business purpose. It's a complete wash. Nobody benefits. Well, except Charter benefits because they're able to capitalize the $20 expense, that is for the set-top boxes. This is just accounting mumbo-jumbo. And they're able to recognize the $20 in advertising revenues immediately. And all that means is they're able to change their short-term profits to make them look more profitable in this quarter because of this accounting mumbo-jumbo. It's just a charade. Okay. The question is, and admittedly, Charter, Scientific Atlanta, and Motorola, the parties on the other side of this watch transaction, they're bad actors here. They were doing something that we don't want them to do, that is commit a fraud on the market. Commit a fraud against all investors. Okay, so we want to deter that. And the question, again, as I said to my mother, who do we want to deter that? Okay. One precedent on point is Central Bank of Denver, Supreme Court case from several years ago. And in that case, there was a very similar transaction. There was a bank. They were the trustees of bondholders. And there were some new bonds that were going to be issued. And the bank's job was basically to look out and make sure everything was on the up and up. The bank sat by while some people raising money through these bonds issued false prospectuses and about appraisals, and it doesn't really matter. But basically, the bank contributed to a speaker in the securities markets committing a fraud. And the Supreme Court says, look, the bank didn't do anything but aid this fraud that was committed by the people raising money through the bonds, and there's no aiding and abetting liability in, as Casey described it, this private right of action. So if the issue for the court was the one that Casey said, is there aiding and abetting liability? The answer is clearly no, and see Central Bank of Denver. As the court wrestled with this new oral argument, Justice Ginsburg kept saying to the respondents, the issue isn't whether there's aiding and abetting liability. We already have a precedent on that point. It's a question of whether there's something in between primary actors, Charter Communications, the people perpetrating the fraud, and aiders and abettors, the bank as trustee, who didn't really do anything other than stand by and watch them or facilitate. Is there this middle category? Okay. After Central Bank, the Congress passed a new statute, Section 20E, that said, oh, wait a second, you said there's no aiding and abetting liability. There actually is aiding and abetting liability under the securities laws, but private lawyers are not the ones to bring these cases. The SEC has the sole authority to go after aiders and abettors. Okay. This was very important because now you've got a Supreme Court precedent and a statute, both of which dramatically limit the role of private lawyers in bringing aiding and abetting. So in the Stoneridge case, to go after Scientific Atlanta and Motorola, what do? they don't call them aiders and abettors, they call it scheme liability. That these guys cooked up a scheme together, and therefore Motorola and Saudi Atlanta weren't really aiding and abetting, it was just a scheme. And they're actually not primary, but sort of secondary actors. Which is just the old story when the law isn't on your side, just call it something different, right? Let's not call a spade, let's call a spade a shovel, and hope that we can get the court to say, oh, those spades are bad, but shovels, they're great, right? Okay. This is why Justice Roberts in the oral argument, and just as a footnote, in preparation for this, I read the transcript of the oral argument, and it's fascinating. And if you've never read one, especially in areas that you're interested in, read the transcripts. Both because they're very illuminating about what's going on in the court and the way the judges think, but also because you can pretend, you can practice to be a litigator. You can read the question from the judge and say to yourself, well, gosh, how would I answer that question? I found it extremely educational. Okay. So Robert says, why shouldn't we be guided by what Congress did in reaction to the central bank case? There we said no aiding and abetting liability. Congress said yes, but only private plaintiffs. Why should we try to extend this? So that's the key issue for the case. Okay. Justice Alito, again, through oral argument, says there is no such thing as this middle category. There is primary, the person who holds up the bank, puts the gun in the teller's face and says, give me the money, and there's the guy in the car, and there's the people who are going to wash the money, and there's that's the two categories of people. There's the people who do the thing, and there's aiders and abettors, the people who hide you in their barn afterwards, right? And there's no middle category. Alito says, just to be clear on this, and he's talking to the counsel for the petitioners, if Charter and the accountants and Scientific Atlanta and Motorola all sat in a room and cooked up this scheme together, and they knew exactly what was going on, would you have a claim against Scientific Atlanta and Motorola? And the counsel says, yeah. Look, they're all agreeing to do this. It's a really bad thing. And Alito says, then I see absolutely no difference between your test and the elements of aiding and abetting. Okay, so what the court does is instead of saying, look, a spade is a spade, and your attempt to call a spade a shovel is not going to get you any purchase here, there are no aiders and abettors, this is something the SEC should be doing, it goes to this reliance element. The court says there is secondary liability, there's this middle category, and if you satisfy all the elements of Section 10b, it's in connection with a security, there's reliance and scienter and causation, then you can be held liable to. The court was basically taking what was the government's position in their brief. And the point here was, as Justice Kennedy says, look, the vendors, Scientific Atlanta and Motorola, they never spoke to anybody. They didn't tell the market anything. They just engaged in this transaction. Therefore, no one could have relied on them. Okay, that's absolutely wrong. That's absolutely wrong because we know from prior law that it's not just statements that you make to the public, which the SEC and private lawyers can go after as securities law violations, but activities, things that you do. Market manipulation, you're not speaking to anybody, but you're altering the markets, and that is something that's punishable. Moreover, the entire area of securities law is premised on the fraud of the market theory from Basis versus Levinson. Plaintiffs never have to show reliance. What they rely on is efficient markets. They rely that the price is set by all the things that go into market prices. So this is exactly the fraud of the market theory. The fraud here perpetrated by Scientific Atlanta and Motorola was to defraud the market price. And they did that not through speaking, but through their conduct. Okay, so that can't be right. Now, the problem then is that this leaves open lots more possibilities that people will come in and say these people are secondary actors and they satisfy all these elements of secondary liability. Okay, quickly, why is the policy of the right wing? Because it sounds like I'm making Professor Nagy's case here. The reason the policy is the right one is because courts are very badly positioned, and this is where the civil procedure point, very badly positioned to be able to make these distinctions. Here's Justice Kennedy, a question. There are any number of kickbacks and mismanagement and petty frauds that go on in business, and business people know that any publicly held company shares are going to be affected by its profits. So I see no limitation on your proposal of liability. That's to the respondents. In other words, look, people in business engage in all kinds of transactions like this for all sorts of reasons, and if you are as a supplier of Charter Communications, imagine yourself and Charter comes to you and says, hey, we'd like you to do something. Ship them not to our facility in Chicago, ship the set-top boxes to our facility in Mexico. Now you're thinking to yourself, what's the scheme that they've cooked up? What is it? Why have they asked us for this particular thing? And then there's this sort of sword of Damocles hanging over your head, and you're thinking to yourself, boy, if it turns out that that's a scheme, and some court will later find or jury that we participated in this, we could be liable for securities fraud. The court really rested on this question of foreign investors and the over-deterrence that's caused by U.S. securities litigation. You might have foreigners who are less likely to do business with American companies for fear of being dragged into court. You might have suppliers all the way through the market who are worried about these cases. This obviously would not be a concern if courts were perfect at sorting through these cases. And we know they're not. We know they're not. These cases are extremely expensive, and plaintiff's lawyers have an incentive to bring them, even when they are totally frivolous. We don't have fee shifting in this country. And if you can impose $10 million on a company in discovery, they're happy to write you a check for $9 million. They're better off, the lawyers are better off, everyone goes home happy, but that's a tax on business that we all pay. And the courts have, there's two types of errors that courts can make. Type one errors, that is false positives, and type two errors, false negatives. If we think that courts are likely, the business kind of conduct at question, like this scheme that they cooked up, is something that's unsustainable in equilibrium, that is, eventually the scheme that Scientific Atlanta and Charter cooked up is going to be revealed. And the people who were responsible for it are going to lose their jobs and be punished. The government could go after them both civilly and criminally. That's very unsustainable. So you've got something where the bad conduct is unsustainable in the market, and courts might make mistakes in finding sinister conduct. That's false one, type one, false positive error. Finding sinister conduct where there is none, we risk imposing lots of costs on businesses. Okay, last word here. Justice Kennedy says in Stone Ridge, overseas firms, this is in the opinion, overseas firms with no other exposure to our securities laws could be deterred from doing business here. This in turn may raise the cost of being a publicly traded company under our law and shift securities offerings away from domestic and capital markets. A real concern about U.S. competitiveness of securities markets. But you know what? Completely inappropriate for a Supreme Court justice to be making these kinds of decisions. That's what Congress should be doing. That is pure policy. No citations, no cases, nothing. And strikingly, here's Kennedy, who also wrote Central Bank. Policy considerations cannot override our interpretation of the text and structure of the act, except to the extent they may be helped to show the adherence of the text, blah, 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 right? So clearly a policy-making decision, but ultimately, and we can talk more about this in the Q&A, I think reaching the right result in terms of trying to push these cases out of the federal courts, especially when the bad conduct is punishable in other ways and in a matter of business, unsustainable and equal.
Well, thank you, Todd and Casey and Martin. It's a pleasure to be here. Let me state at the outset where I've come out on some of the issues raised by Casey in the introduction and Professor Henderson. First, in my view, the Supreme Court reached an incorrect decision in 1994 when it ruled in Central Bank. It got the law wrong. Rule 10b-5 should have been read to support a private right of action for aiding and abetting a primary violation of Rule 10b-5, even if a person's aid or substantial assistance amounted to merely sitting back and remaining silent and allowing a fraud to occur. I think that it could well be that it was policy that was driving that decision, although, as Professor Henderson ended his remarks with, Justice Kennedy himself, the author of the opinion, and in the majority said policy does not really belong here. That was a textual interpretation of Rule 10b-5 and Section 10b. He said the statute does not extend to aiding and abetting liability. Second, I think the Supreme Court reached an incorrect decision in 2008 when it decided the Stone Ridge case. There, I would argue, and Professor Henderson explained that the defendants did not just sit back and allow fraud to occur. Those who say this was Central Bank revisited are wrong. Central Bank was a case of doing nothing. Stone Ridge was a case of conduct where the participants in the scheme actually engaged in conduct that is fraudulent. Not only did the scheme have no economic purpose, the wash sales, but the scheme also involved the backdating of documents. They made this scheme seem like it was unconnected. And in order to do that, in order to trick the accountants of Charter Communications, it falsified documents. It said that it had price increases for cable box tops where it had no price increases. And it said it was purchasing advertising when it didn't need the advertising to begin with. And the fraud could not have been perpetrated had they not altered the documents to trick the accountant. So the so-called secondary actors in Stone Ridge themselves engaged in fraudulent conduct. And while there's a lot of policy involved in these decisions, there's also a lot of law involved in these decisions. The text of Section 10B and the text of Rule 10b-5 make it unlawful to commit fraud in connection with the purchase or sale of the security. So the actors in the Stone Ridge case themselves engaged in a fraud that was connected to the purchase and sale of security. Justice Kennedy, in that opinion, recognizing that the tax that he so loved in Central Bank actually cut the other way here in Stone Ridge, put a lot of policy in that decision. Those on the side of the majority in Stone Ridge that were filing amicus briefs with the court arguing that the Eighth Circuit decision should be affirmed and that Rule 10b-5 does not extend to the scheme that was involved here made lots of policy arguments in the brief. This time, the plaintiff's bar had the text on their side, and it did become a case in. So I think the Supreme Court erred in its decision in Stone Ridge, and precisely for the reasons that Professor Henderson said. Fraud on the market theory entitles investors to a presumption that they relied on conduct to their detriment. And here, the conduct, assuming the plaintiffs would show that it was fraudulent, would itself be a violation. As Professor Henderson said, the Securities and Exchange Commission could have sued the defendants, not for aiding and abetting liability, but for their primary violation of Rule 10b-5. And the Justice Department could have sued, again, for a primary violation of Rule 10b-5. So there's a lot of law here. There's a lot of policy, but there's a lot of law. So, given my belief that the Supreme Court erred in both Central Bank and Stone Ridge, it should probably come as no surprise to any of you that I would support legislation designed to overturn those decisions. Private plaintiffs should be able to sue those persons who knowingly or recklessly provide substantial assistance to a third party that violates the securities laws. So the person or the entity that remains silent in Central Bank should be able to be prosecuted, and that they would need an aiding and abetting statute in order to be liable. The Stone Ridge defendants, I would argue, would be liable under good old Rule 10b-5, but if Congress wants to amend the laws and make it really clear that even if this were only aiding and abetting liability, it would be subject to private action, I think that's really good as well, because this way we don't have to fight so much about whether or not someone just remains silent or whether someone actually engaged in actively deceptive conduct. Now, why should we have aiding and abetting liability in private actions? Well, Professor Henderson put this as a choice, or at least he put this as a choice to his mom last night at dinner, whether it should be the government or it should be private law. Well, I would say that's a false choice. It should be the government and it should be private lawyers. The government can't be everywhere, and to the extent that part of the idea of liability is to deter bad actors, we want as much deterrence as possible. So why should we have aiding and abetting liability in private actions? Well, I would say for two reasons. One, for compensation, and secondly, for deterrence. Well, let's take the deterrence first. the argument can be made, well, certainly the SEC's ability to bring actions and should be deterrence, and certainly the Department of Justice's ability to bring an action and potentially lock someone in jail for deceptive conduct should be enough deterrence. But I think history has shown, and front page headlines have shown, that that type of deterrence just isn't adequate, given the multitude of schemes and the incredible creativity and the incredible greediness that is out there in our security markets there. And I would say that so-called secondary actors particularly need deterrence. Why? Because we often rely on the gatekeepers. Interestingly, Stone Ridge is a case that involved vendors who are participants in the scheme. More often than not, we see it is securities professionals or professionals like accountants and lawyers who assist in schemes to defraud the public. Those gatekeepers, the lawyers, the accountants, the investment bankers, the credit rating agencies, they don't gain as much from the fraud that is actually perpetrated out there in the market. Their incentives are smaller. They're not the Bernie Madoffs who are making the huge amounts of money. They're not the Enrons who are able to claim, or the WorldComs who are able to claim huge profits when in fact they have financial statements that have been fraud. They don't have as much at stake here. So because they don't stand as much to gain for their participation in the fraud, it takes much less to deter them. And so if they don't face liability to private plaintiffs, and if these secondary actors only fear the government, they very well may say, well, it's worth it just this time because the chances of us getting caught are so small. Well, one thing that actors do fear is being sued by private individuals and this so-called plaintiff bars. And so the idea that private investors with their lawyers who have incentive to sue can in fact make them liable, I think will deter bad conduct. And I think that's something we all want. I also think that allowing secondary actors to be liable under aiding and abetting type statutes provides a vehicle for compensation. Often enough in these cases, the primary violator, the company with the fraudulent financial statements, has gone bankrupt. See Enron, see WorldCom, see, well, Madoff has his assets frozen. So they cannot provide the compensation to the individuals who have been harmed. The secondary actors who were either themselves committing fraud, i.e. Stone Ridge, or sitting back and allowing a fraud to happen, i.e. Central Bank, have engaged in activity that is wrongful. And they can't be liable unless private plaintiffs show that they knowingly sat back and allowed, or knowingly or recklessly sat back and allowed a fraud to occur. And so these bad actors, which everyone agrees are bad actors, can significantly help the investors who are defrauded reaching into their pockets and paying for their bad, wrongful, and I would argue most often illegal conduct. My time up? It's up. Okay, there we have it.
Alright, thank you both very much. I thought I would start off the Q&A session by giving Professor Henderson a quick 2-minute rebuttal to respond to some of Professor Nagy's claims, and then I'll move on to some of the questions that I scripted and during the interview.
Do I get to rebut his
rebuttal? Yeah. That was a part of the script that I got, but that's okay. Okay, so very quickly. A couple of things that I would just, a couple of questions, I guess. One, Professor Nagy said there's a big difference between being silent and acting. I'm not so sure. I mean, you know, we've all had first year law school in this room, and the act-omission distinction is a slippery one. So I'm resting so much on that, I'm not 100% sure about that. She said, as much deterrence as possible. Okay, this is just the Chicago person in me. that is the law school and law and economics, that can't be right. We don't want as much deterrence as possible. We want the optimal amount of deterrence. And the amount of fraud that happens in the market, the optimal amount of fraud that happens in the market is clearly not zero. Because there's a cost to stamping out all fraud. It's like approaching the speed of light, right? You get to 97% of the speed of light pretty quickly, and then going from 97 to 98, to that, it becomes very costly. So I think, you know, we don't want to go as fast as possible. We want to go the optimal speed. We want the optimal amount of deterrence. And stamping out, you know, providing deterrence is not costless because of the false positive, false negative problem. Yes, if we could costlessly, without decision costs and error costs, because courts are both, right? Cost money to for courts to process these cases, and also they make errors, which are costly, and they deter conduct that is the false negative, that is the false positive. That is, it's not sinister conduct, but it's proven to be so in a court. That's something I think that we need to take into consideration. About compensation, I'm not so sure that's really that important. First of all, plaintiffs usually get nothing in these cases, right? The lawyers are the people who benefit primarily. Most of these cases involve, it's a giant wealth transfer from investors to lawyers, especially when they settle. Okay, you might all think that's a good idea, but I'm more socially minded than all of you, I guess, but maybe that's because, you know, I have tenure and I have a job. But also, I think we want diversified shareholders. Anything that encourages people to invest in individual companies, in my personal opinion, is a bad idea. And if I'm a diversified shareholder, I really don't care at some level whether Charter Communications is engaged in this fraud. I win over here, I lose over here. It's just money that I move between my pockets. So I'm not sure compensation is that crucial. The only thing I will say about the proposed Section 21D is at least the right people are asking the question, right? At least it's something that Congress is doing, whether they should effectively repeal Section 20E and impose aiding and abetting liability, because they're politically accountable. And judges are not politically accountable. So that's the only thing I can say that's good about this. I think it's happening at a very politically inopportune time, but we can talk more about that.
I guess since Professor Nagy is the one that taught me two classes of securities law to be able to do this today, I'll give her a couple minutes for a quick response.
Okay, quick response. For
Professor
Hippel,
get lots too.
One of the other things Congress did in 1995 is provide a presumption that the lead plaintiff in a securities class action is the person who has, or the entity that has the most at stake, which means that today it's institutional investors who are typically the lead plaintiff in these actions. In cases where, like Enron and WorldCom, the company itself has gone bankrupt, secondary actors can contribute significantly into the pool of recovery that is available to private plaintiffs. And we've seen this, because in Enron, many investment banks settled billions of dollars which have been distributed to wronged investors. And that money came from, there was other ones who didn't settle, got lucky because the Fifth Circuit denied the class certification. And that's a whole other issue there. Casey, want to ask us questions?
Sure. Thank you both for what you've provided so far. The new bill has a recklessness standard, and I wanted to dig into that a little bit. Going forward, if the bill were to pass, what would lawyers and financial advisors have to do to ensure that if their clients were perpetrating a fraud, that their conduct didn't rise to the level of actionable? So in other words, how could they protect themselves going forward if the Spectre bill were to pass? And I think I'll let Professor Anderson start.
Okay, so just so I understand the question is, if this bill passes, and the question is, any person that knowingly or recklessly provides substantial assistance, what would they do to protect themselves? That's a good question. I'm not someone who, for my day job, provides advice to boards or companies on matters like this. So here, now this is me going far afield of what I feel comfortable doing. So, my guess is, to make my side of the argument, they're going to hire a bunch of lawyers, and they're going to be very cautious. They're going to impose transactions costs on them. So in the past, where they would have, Charter Communications says, we want you to ship these to a different place, or we want to, do some other deal with you, they're going to ask lots of questions about that transaction. They're going to document exactly what it is, that the justifications. They're going to have to go through some lawyer approvals. The general counsel is going to be involved in approving substantial changes to business arrangements. I can imagine all kinds of things that boards and sort of lawyers and firms will do, which may impose costs. Because the specter of securities fraud liability is a pretty big one. We've seen there's been a history of whenever there's the increase in liability, it has a dramatic effect, and people are afraid of lawyers. This is a good thing to learn for all of you. We are feared. My dad didn't speak to me for a year after I decided to go to law school, because in his world, he was a nuclear engineer and building nuclear plants. We were the reason for the demise of his entire industry and his life's work. So I think there is an overreaction, and that's admittedly an overreaction. I think there is an overreaction by business people. They just don't understand what we do, and they're afraid of it. There's this whole legal system, and God forbid we jury and get sued in Mississippi. Apologies, anybody who's from Mississippi. So I think analytically, if we were all rational and everybody's reaction to the statute was completely rational, they wouldn't have to do too much. Just don't act like a bad guy. I think people will overreact. And I think it's that overreaction which will be another substantial cost for businesses. But maybe President Aidy has some other take on this.
Well, I have a different take on the facts of Stonebridge. I mean, we can't make the suppliers and the vendors who then became the customers seem like they were somehow, just careless and whoops, didn't know that we were engaging in this wash transaction. They forged documents, they backdated documents, and they knew full well why Charter Communications wanted them to do it, because they knew full well that Charter Communications was going to use the numbers to inflate their revenue for their financial statement. So let's say, don't forge documents, don't backdate, don't lie to another company's accountants. Those seem like very reasonable rules that parties in commercial transactions should follow. In terms of professionals like lawyers, like accountants, Casey's question was, well, what can they do to ensure that they are not found to be knowingly or recklessly providing substantial assistance to other persons? Well, it's not a negligence standard. So hiring a battery of lawyers to help you be more careful, maybe companies will do that. Maybe law firms will hire their own lawyers. I don't think so. Care is, or due care, is not what the statute requires. What the statute says is you can't knowingly help your client commit fraud, and you can't recklessly help your client commit fraud. So what does recklessly mean in that context? It means that you as the lawyer can't act like an ostrich. You can't put your head in the sand and pretend you don't see what is happening. It also means that you as the lawyers can't write up documents that you know are misrepresenting facts and are going to be used, even if the law firm's name is not on it, the client's name is not on that. Recklessly and knowingly are very high levels of scienter that need to be shown. And the pleading requirements say that unless a plaintiff in one of these private lawsuits can show facts providing a strong inference that you acted knowingly or recklessly as a lawyer, the case cannot survive. So I think this idea that somehow lawyers are going to have to hire lawyers to see that they act with due care is not going to happen. Lawyers who stick their heads in the sand are going to fear sticking their heads in the sand, and I think that's a really good thing.
Well, just one very quick point, which is, let me be clear, I'm not here to defend at all what Motorola and Scientific Atlanta did. And I agree, anybody who engages in that kind of conduct should be punished. And there are other forms of punishment, we should be clear. And Professor Nagy's point that I was giving a false choice between the government and private lawyers is absolutely true. There's, you know, these guys lost their jobs. They lost their, they can be sued by shareholders for defrauding the company and getting bonuses they shouldn't have had. I mean, there's all kinds of other, that you get negative publicity, reputational costs. There's all kinds of other elements of this. Just to the question about recklessly. So now Charter Communications comes to you and says, we'd like to ship these to a different location. What is the response of the supplier going to be in the world after the statute's passed? It's not going to be, great, we're happy to have you as our customers. We're glad to ship these boxes to another location. The customer's always right. That's not what they're going to say. Why? Why do you want us to ship them to their location? Are you guys up to something? That's very strange to happen between people who are doing business together, right? Because the kinds of, you know, I mean, it's classical issues about negotiation and, you know, transactions between suppliers and businesses. You don't want to raise those kinds of issues in relationships. I asked my wife to do some kind of tax dodge on the eve of our wedding, and she didn't talk to me for a week. There's a kind of a pattern here. My relatives not talking to me. Because it was a weird thing to say in a relationship, right? Because I'm just a, you know, cold-hearted, economically minded, rational person, and you know, to her it was about love. So how can you get $10,000 a year? What are you talking about? I think that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. It's very strange to impose this kind of obligation on business partners, especially when these kinds of frauds, they're unsustainable in equilibrium, and there's other ways to punish them. But we can talk about it. More questions.
Okay, some of you may have to escape, and so if we could just give them a round of applause real quick. One more question that I had after everyone gets a chance to scoot out, and then I'll open it up to you guys for a couple more questions.
Make some more sandwiches.
Yeah, take a sandwich for the road.
Makes me a pervy.
So again, I'll ask a question that asks you to maybe to step outside of your professor roles and just think about the practical application of the bill and how Washington works. But does the Specter language being incorporated into the Dodge bill, what effect does that have on its ultimate passability? And do you think ultimately that it will be passed? That's A. You want to start?
The Dodd bill, at least in the sort of triple spaced format, I think is 1,000 pages long. So I had to dive in, and I eventually did a PDF search to actually find the aiding and abetting liability section because I didn't have time to wait for the whole thing. So I mean, it is, the Dodd bill is huge, and sets up a consumer financial product commission, and it reorganizes banking. And Congress is going to be fighting about that for a while. And I'm not sure whether Specter's two-page bill, this is Specter's bill, and it's really just a paragraph. I'm not sure whether that's going to just, you know, fall into the sunset as we debate all the issues surrounding financial regulation. I think Specter will make the argument, you know, let's just do my little old bill first, and then we can, you know, change the world as we know it. But politically, I'm not really sure what Washington's going to do.
Oh boy, there must be people on our faculty and the faculty here who know things about politics, and I just don't. One thing we would want, desire, if it's true that Congress is the appropriate or the better locus for resolution of the policy questions, that must be premised on accountability, like tenured judges, politically accountable agents of the people. So then you'd want to ask a sort of an empirical question, well, is this bill where you decide on your own, or this bill where the same content is buried in a compromise of other things, which of those empirically is likely to lead to greater accountability? If they make a mistake and it turns out that 5 years from now, no foreign companies raise money in the United States, there's enormous deadweight costs imposed by the kind of parade of horribles that I imagine about lawyering up all these contracts and these negotiations. If that's true, will the people who pass this be accountable, and will we see a reversal? And which is more likely in these particular situations? Which cases are the people who are making the decisions more likely to focus on the merits of the thing and have a good debate about it? I could have a gut-level instinct that prefers this to that, but it's really just a gut level, you know, it's not more than that. So my guess is I would prefer it to be, let's have a debate about Senate resolution bill, you know, 1551. And maybe that gets 5 minutes on the news, maybe there's some blogs that write about it, and a little bit more than transparency than if it's buried in the bill. But I don't know, compromise and log rolling, and boy, it's complicated.
Yeah, I'd actually add to that, I totally agree that by having a bill with 75 sections, it makes talking about any one in particular section in an intelligent manner very difficult. It makes the legislative history almost non-existent because you get 5 minutes of airtime, and it makes that difficult. I also think, and I think Congress, as part of the PSLRA in 1995, put aiding and abetting, or restored aiding and abetting, for the Securities and Exchange Commission as part of the PSLRA. And, you know, that got 5 minutes of airtime. I think everyone agrees it was the right thing to do. One of the things that strikes me, and I must say I've never focused on it before until last night, I actually think that Congress has the wrong wording in what it is trying to do. Because the statute says, for purposes of any private civil action applied under this title, any person that knowingly or recklessly provides substantial assistance to another person in violation of this title. Grammatically, that probably means that the person who is being sued pursuant to this provision has to violate this title, which might be the case in Stone Ridge, but is not the case in Central Bank. I think what Congress means to say is anyone who knowingly or recklessly provides substantial assistance to another person, enabling a violation of this statute. So I think Congress needs to put in enabling a violation of this statute. So then we could say, well, what's the chances Congress is going to do this on Chris Dodd's bill? I think very small. If all we had before us was the Specter bill, then maybe someone might say, you know, bring in your fifth grade grammar teacher. What you mean to say, Congress, is enabling a violation of this act. And so that's just one small example, but in a mammoth piece of legislation, we tend not to focus on the specific words as much. And that's a real shame, because law is words, and we're going to be debating about this sometime.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the one final point to make is, if you ask me how I vote on this bill, I would say no. Yeah, Henderson votes no. When I'm elected, I will vote no on this bill, which is never. If you ask me how I vote on the Dodd bill, boy, I have no idea. I really like some parts about it. The reorganization of the Fed and banking, whatever, and I'm not super informed, but that sounds like a good... The consumer idea, that's a terrible idea, right? This, I'm no... Okay, round two! I don't know. And therefore, you know, and if I go back to my constituents now, and again, this is just the downside of the aggregated conglomerate version of lawmaking, I go back to my constituents and I say, oh, I wasn't voting for it because of this thing, which turned out to be terrible, you know, cats and dogs living together in mass hysteria. Oh, no. I thought the consumer protection thing was really great, and that's why I voted for it. Okay, questions? Mary.
You mentioned how this type of procedure would be economically unsustainable, but I'm having trouble seeing your point there, because if I give you $20 to avoid facing the big bad auditor, and then when he leaves, you give me back the $20, we're even. That's the point of a lost sale. So how would that be economically unsustainable?
What I mean by that is that ultimately, no one is fooled by short-term gaming of earnings announcements. So if I say to you, instead of, you know, taking a $5 expense now, I'm going to do it over five periods, right? This might make my earnings look better in this period, but my earnings are going to look worse in these periods. And so rational, sophisticated investors will look at this and say, you know, there's no difference between these two things. And they could look at Charter Communications set-top box prices and compare them with the set-top box prices of other competitors and say, well, there's something weird going on here. So in other words, the only thing that the Charter earnings manipulation did was it maybe benefited some executives by their stock options or their short-term bonuses. It maybe allowed them to stave off, you know, bankruptcy or something that was coming in the very short run. What I mean by an equilibrium is frauds by businesses like this, gaming of earnings announcements, are unsustainable. WorldCom tried it, Adelphia tried it, Charter tried it. They don't work in the long run. So in the long run, what I'm saying is there is substantial pressure not to do these things. Not perfect pressure, but substantial not pressure not to do them because it will eventually be uncovered. Now, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Why do it if it doesn't work, and who has the time, though we mentioned transaction costs, to look at earnings in this much detail?
Okay. Why do it if it doesn't work? Again, it's not in the real firm interest. It's probably the executives who may have good, there's a white hat story and a black hat story. The black hat story is, my stock options are vesting, I'm going to sell them. I want the stock price to be higher in this period because it's going to get me a bonus or stock options or something like that. Okay, that's the black hat story. The white hat story, and one that they've tried at WorldCom and Adelphi and a bunch of other frauds, was, boy, the day of reckoning, if we could just put it off by another year or another quarter, things may turn around. The economy may turn around. We may be able to avoid this. So there's kind of a save the firm, like commit fraud against our investors so that we can save the firm. Yeah. So there's two reasons to do it. And again, I don't know the motives of the people involved here. Both of them are bad. One is worse than the other. But the only point I was making is there are competitive pressures that tend to unravel these things. In the same way that a cartel, right? We agree to fix prices. People can agree to fix prices. In the short run, sometimes prices can be fixed. There are no, the exception of OPEC, and that doesn't even work perfectly, there are no cartels that last in the long run in equilibrium because of the competitive pressures to unwind them.
All right, thank you.
Yeah.
More questions?
Trent? To But that's to what extent are your overdeterrence concerns that they be addressed by striking the reckless element from the statute?
So that's a good question. So knowingly, I mean, the problem with any just knowingly, I mean, every statute that you've ever read, right, says no or should have known. And that's basically what this is, right? You could just say no or should have known because it creates the ostrich problem. It creates the willful blindness problem.
Should have known would be a negligence standard.
Right. Okay, yeah.
So
okay.
It was reckless and not knowing.
Exactly. Right. So no or should have known, meaning the ostrich problem. Here they're doing it in a, Professor Nagy rightly points out, in a slightly more favorable way. They're trying to get the Hendersons to come on board by not doing no or should have known, but no and or recklessly should have known. So I don't think that statute would be, if I'm on Professor Nagy, so I don't think I'd be very pleased with that. And I don't think I would be very pleased with it either, just because it really wouldn't be doing anything. And it would be just sort of a facade. And it encourages people to, you know, I think it encourages them to sort of, well, you know, I don't know. It encourages sort of lying, subsidiary lie, you know, another level of lying. So, you know, I guess it'd be better than this for me, because there'd be fewer suits from that point.
I guess I would just respond that I think the legal standard for recklessness is incredibly high. It doesn't mean should have known. It means taking affirmative steps to be willfully blind to the truth. And that's very hard to show. And the pleading requirements now in private litigation since 1995 require specific facts giving rise to a strong inference that someone willfully shut their eyes or willfully stuck their head in the sand. So given what it takes to show recklessness, in many cases, knowingly is sufficient. Charter Communications is a case that knowingly would have carried the day. And in many of these cases, the conduct is so egregious, and the lawyers knew, or the accountants knew, or the inventor trustee knew, that having to show knowledge is effectively what the plaintiffs are doing, in part because the standard of recklessness is so high.
I think just, you know, there were some interesting things that Zanetti raised about, you know, the PSLRA and really hanging her hat on that. And obviously the PSLRA, the changes about who the lead plaintiffs are and what the pleading standards are, was a response to an academic literature from the 80s suggesting about these strike suits. Has it been effective? Again, I don't know. It's sort of an empirical question. There have been papers written. Do the merits matter more after the PSLRA? Are the lead plaintiffs actually better? Are institutional shareholders the right plaintiffs? And I think those are all very unresolved questions. Jim Cox had a paper about institutional investors leaving money on the table. Money they were entitled to collect, billions of dollars sitting in a fund that they could go and just sort of show up and take, and they weren't doing it. And the reason is, what's that?
After Brutes.
Yeah. And the reason they weren't going after it is because the 32-year-old MBA who manages the XYZ fund is not, she's not compensated based on settlement monies that she gets. That doesn't go in. She's compensated on metrics that have nothing to do with these, you know, is she a good stock picker? Not, did I get some settlement money? The institutionalizers don't even really know how to account for that. So you have to go to the incentives of these guys, and that's a lot of open empirical questions about the PSLRA. I tend to be more bearish about that. She's more bullish, and I think that predicts where we're gonna line up in this.
Well, and a lot of that involves conflicts of interest. I mean, if the pension fund manager who is entitled to bring in millions of dollars back into his fund decides not to do so, I really want to know why he's deciding not to do so, because the investors to whom he owes fiduciary duties are entitled to that money. When you scratch the surface, often the institutional investor didn't want to collect money they were entitled to because they want to do business with the company that paid the settlement, and they want pension fund business from that company. And that's outrageous, in my opinion. So, you know, I agree that money is sometimes left on the table by the institutional investors. One of the public benefits I think that scholarship like Jim Cox and Randy Thomas have done is they've put this out into the limelight such that institutional investors now are ashamed when they leave money on the table. And I think that's a really good thing.
Okay, I think we probably have time for one more question. Nick?
One quick question, maybe a follow-up question.
That's two questions.
Okay, am I correct in reading this to say that it's taking lawyers more off the sidelines? That a lawyer in a firm or in a legal department can be taken into court just for giving advice? Or is it? If a client comes to me and says, at what point my actions become fraud, and I say, here's the line, they say, oh, okay, we're going to go over it this month. Do I become liable at that point? Or do I become liable if I help them, or if I give them further advice on how to get happy or not get caught?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you could go to jail if you could lose your license as a lawyer. And so all of that, you know, assuming you have the mental state to intentionally or recklessly engage.
My real question. In general, rules tend to favor the powerful, not just because the powerful ones make rules, but because they're also the ones that have the means to get past them. Doesn't this law, or laws like it, set up a two-tier situation where you're going to have corporations whose lawyers are willing to go to bat, willing to risk their licenses for them, and corporations where the lawyers are not because of how much money they have? And if a corporation makes up like 80% of a firm's business, aren't they going to be much more likely to turn a blind eye, especially considering how you talked about how it's a very difficult standard to prove. I mean, there's a 1% chance to lose my license versus millions in business.
No, I think sure. Some law firms, accounting firms, you fill in the blank of the professional advisor are going to feel that the business is more important to them than the chance of being caught. I mean, that's what deterrence is. And so, Professor Henderson and I are not saying completely different things here. It's under the law, the lawyer who knowingly assists the client in committing fraud can. Lots of bad things can happen. They can A, go to jail. The Justice Department can prosecute. B, they can lose their license. And C, the SEC could bring an action against the lawyer. So you have A, B, and C already in the status quo. We need no change of legislation for that. The question is, do we want to add a D? You can also be liable to private plaintiffs in a federal securities action. I would say, well, gee, if we think this conduct is bad enough to A, throw someone in jail, B, make them lose their license, C, hold them liable to the Securities and Exchange Commission, then why don't we put D in there as well? And that goes to the topic of the optimal amount of deterrence. Professor Henderson says that there's going to be too much cost associated with prevention of that activity. I say I don't really think so, and I think having D along with A, B, and C is going to prevent a lot of lawyers from engaging in that conduct.
So since I'm a visitor, I'm gonna have take the privilege of having a last word.
Okay, so let me give you one reason why that's pretty powerful. So let me give you one reason why that might not be such a great idea. If we believe, right, that as she said, there's sort of A, B, C, and D. And if we believe this was just adding a little bit of extra insurance at a fairly low cost, and we could differ about the cost of this and the benefits of this, then that doesn't sound like so unreasonable to me. If, however, A, B, or C don't take their jobs as seriously because of the presence of D, then that might be something that worries us. And that is, so take another case that's before the Supreme Court. That's Jones versus Harris, which involves mutual fund fees. As far as I know, the SEC has never, ever, ever brought a case against a mutual fund for overpaying. They've relied on D, the private lawyers, to do it. Well, bad, because the private lawyers are 0-for-150 in these cases. They've never won. And their incentives are to sue the wrong people. The reason is, imagine giant fund, lots of money, little fund, less money, and these guys are the ones, this is industry expert telling me this, are the ones who are more likely to commit the fraud.
this is sort of your point about the power. These guys are the guys who have the money. And you're a lawyer, and it costs the same to bring the suit against both of them. Who are you going to sue? Well, you're going to sue these guys. So the Venn diagram of misbehaving firms, funds in that case, and people are sued by the private lawyers, does not overlap, right? And the SEC doesn't bring any of these cases because, well, the existence of Dean. So a real, so if we remove this and we say, you know what, you're on your own, Section 20E, Congress, you're responsible for prosecuting, aiding, the SEC, you're responsible for prosecuting, aiding, and abetting, if that gets the SEC to take their jobs more seriously and actually bring these cases, that could be a good thing. And the sort of false reliance on the private lawyers who may not have the right incentives may actually be a negative thing, even though we believe it might be additive.
But there's another side to it.
I thought I had the last word.